Well, welcome everyone back to our mid-morning presentation. Just a brief announcement, so the presenters and chairs know. Sorry to the rest of you, but the presenters and chairs get free lunch upstairs if you would like to take advantage of that. Yesterday there was a lot of extra food, so please do take advantage. It's my pleasure this morning to introduce Dr. Ruben Basile. He's going to talk about recent work from Argentina's Espacio Fairbairn. Dr. Basile has an MD in psychiatry from the University of Buenos Aires, an honors degree. He's a full member of the Argentine Psychoanalytic Association, a professor at APA seminars, a training analyst, and a training supervisor, and the author of several books and papers published in Argentina and abroad. He's a founding member and coordinator of Espacio Fairbairn, APA. So I'm looking forward to hearing his talk this morning, and I'll turn it over to you.
Thank you very much. First, I should like to express my deepest acknowledgement to to Graham Clark because of inviting me here. Then, emptiness pathology. Emptiness pathology, a useful psychoanalytical contribution to mental disorder awareness, is helpful, albeit imprecise, like the concept of borderline. Comorbidity is high, very high. Our objectives are, one, to pinpoint emptiness pathology in Fairbairn's model. It is closely related to the object and the object relationship. It is a pre-Oedipal pathology in patients with borderline personality organization and less frequently with psychotic personality organization, fundamentally schizoid and narcissistic serious and atypical psychosis. Schizoaffective psychosis, DSM-4, also in schizophrenia, especially in type 2. Emptiness pathology could be an adjective in search of a noun, borderline or psychosis. Only a psychoanalyst in the transference and countertransference can diagnose emptiness pathology. Due to their specific quality of emptiness, transference and countertransference are an important parameter to take into account when making a diagnosis. Two, to conceptualize emptiness pathology as a conflict featuring A, separation, abandonment, anxieties, specifically marked by feelings of hollowness, emptiness in mind and body. In clinical work, abandonment anxieties are not felt as such, but rather as depreciation. When abandonment appears, depreciation and emptiness disappear, the patient gets better. Anhedonia is an important symptom. Pedro, nothing gives me joy. I feel empty in mind and body since I lost my job. This coexisted with an anxiety of annihilation of the ego and of the object. I feel like I am going crazy, like I have no place left in the world. Emptiness coexists with feelings of futility, despair, disappointment, loneliness, and depreciation. These feelings go hand in hand with instances of acting out with emptiness contents whose purpose is to recover a part object, empty breast, or a whole object, empty mother, always with a part object relationship. These symptoms are explained by self-esteem regulation alteration. Self-esteem is systematically diminished, dissociated, and projected on the analyst. And at this point, there is an attempt to regulate it through the object relationship with a transitional object and consistently empty object, the analyst. Pedro says, I feel empty. I feel like both you and the consulting room are empty. there is an emptiness between you and me. In the transference, the analyst would evince a conflict tension between the patient, the split ego, and ego ideal. This is expressed as contempt, disappointment, uncertainty, and anhedonia by the patient and the analyst, which together with emptiness may pervade the session and constitute a significant barrier. B, defense. We advance the concept that emptiness as Rubens did with depression. Both often coexist as empty depression, a severe resistance revolving around the loss of omnipotent control on a bad, libidinal, appreciated, needed, transitional object, the analyst, with an emptiness quality, a transitional object that protects the patient from abandonment. Emptiness as a defense aims at keeping an object lost and conscious. This object has an emptiness quality, breast, mother, wife, analyst, and causes a feeling of abandonment, sometimes preceding psychosis. The schizoid phenomenon triggers primitive dissociation, which in turn triggers omnipotent control on a libidinal transitional object with an ever-present emptiness quality, whose loss or threat of loss sparks emptiness, an empty depression feeling with a tendency to lose the boundaries between ego and non-ego and past and present. The increase of primitive dissociation results in acting out. When primitive dissociation fails due to the loss of omnipotent control of the object, confusion comes in. Empty depression manifests itself previously masked by instances of acting out, which tend to disappear. Afterwards, delirium and real hallucination may come in due to a prevalence of projective phenomena. They are an attempt to recover the lost object with quality of emptiness, emptiness-related acute schizoaffective psychosis. The threat of loss of a transitional object with quality of emptiness, the analyst, increases the schizoid phenomena, the omnipotent control of the object, and instances of acting out with emptiness content, a prevalence of dissociated mechanisms. Confusion and delirium, hallucinations, are manifestations of the primitive dissociation failure. Delirium and hallucinations are prompted by a prevalence of projective mechanisms over dissociative ones. When the lost object, the analyst, is recovered, emptiness, confusion, delirium disappear, paving the way for feelings of abandonment because the object lost becomes conscious. Extrapolating from Rubens, we maintain that the feeling of emptiness and depression often coexists as empty depression, acting a significant resistance to making the object lost and abandonment conscious. C, contents are empty with respect to the mind, the erogenous dry body, and the image of the body. All of them splitting. Emptiness contents usually coexist with other pre-Oedipal contents, such as futility and loneliness and mania and anhedonia, the quintessential symptom of emptiness pathology inherent in the schizoid series of which emptiness pathology is part. Due to the resignification of the schizoid conflict in the Oedipus conflict, Oedipal contents, incest, parasite, phallic, take on pre-Oedipal qualities, engulfing abandonment, annihilation of the ego and of the objects, and vice versa. Castration contents are embodied in Maria. Each time I have intercourse, I feel my stomach empty, as if my womb had been removed, and therefore I won't have any children. My parents won't love me, and Juan will leave me. Incest, parasite, phallic castration, contents acquired qualities of closeness, distance, and emptiness. Anxieties related to the abandonment, annihilation of the ego, and phallic contents appear in Juan's panic attacks. Each time he kisses or is kissed on the mouth, Juan says, "I feel penetrated and sucked with the tongue, emptied, and afterwards I feel I disappear. When I kiss my wife, I feel I am sucking her, and then I feel that she disappears. With her tongue, she penetrates me, invading me, capturing me, emptying me, fusing with me." This sentence disappeared when interpreting kissing being kissed was to penetrate, be penetrated, to suck, be sucked, to capture, be captured, to be subsequently emptied, castrated, abandoned, with an eventual feeling of disappearing or of part of the body. In this case, testicle, penis, emptiness. Carlos, when I approach a woman who arouses me, I would suck her whole, and in the end, I fear I would choke. Left without a woman, abandoned, feeling an emptiness in my stomach. Our interpretation is that the woman, whole object treated as breast, part object, serves as an empty breast, kissed, sucked, swallowed, to avoid losing it when it is swallowed. The patient is alone and empty. He would be choking in order to avoid losing it. Ambivalence, emptiness. 3, to define what we have called object situation. Part or whole objects, breast, mother, empty, analyst, always with the part or whole relationship. Often in borderlands, the object is treated as conscious, oral, anal, phallic, urethral. This transitional object with quality of emptiness, breast, mother, analyst in the transference, may be fetishized. Fetishized is a concept that comes from Winnicott, protesting the patient not only from abandonment and annihilation of the ego, but also from castration anxieties. This is observed in perversions. The borderline patient with predominantly perverse symptoms and with emptiness pathology, to avoid losing his mother, wife, empty analyst, and being abandoned, may vomit, urinate, defecate the object, feeling empty, perverse, but not psychotic. Paul, borderline with predominantly perverse symptoms. When I get late and have a good orgasm, I feel fused with my woman, and afterwards I get lost in space and time, and I go crazy. Sometimes I hear funny voices, but if I hold the little hollow ball, which is a fetishized transitional object, I mean a transitional object that now is also a fetish, I feel an emptiness in my head, in my genitals, but I don't go crazy, although I piss and shit on her. Our interpretation is that he feels empty in order not to feel abandoned and avoid becoming psychotic. Afterwards, the patient has feelings of abandonment and emptiness disappear. Point four, extrapolating from Ferben, we propose that emptiness pathology is a clinical indicator of an unconscious mechanism inherent in the transitional stage. This psychological maneuver aims at recovering and maintaining an object relationship with a whole, possibly part object, always with a part object relationship, an object that is always bad, empty, libidinal, exciting, frustrated, rejected, but also appreciated, needed, narcissistic, and transitional. A breast, a mother, the analyst, empty, emptied with, when the patient established an empty, emptied bone, to ward off abandonment. The appearance of the analyst in the session and in the process, the analyst, for instance, the analyst who's on vacation, makes emptiness disappear and abandonment appear. 5, to propose that emptiness pathology may constitute a significant barrier to making the unconscious conscious, the loss of objects, abandonment and depression, underlying emptiness. This is observed in schizoid characteropathy and schizotypal personalities. 6, transference, countertransference. If the analyst has an insufficiently analyzed emptiness pathology during the transference, his patient may be transformed into a transitional object with qualities of emptiness. Patient and analyst protect themselves with emptiness in the transference, counter-transference, from abandonment and the unconscious feeling of object loss. They mutually transform into transitional objects with quality of emptiness. 7, to assert that emptiness is not only resistance, but also transference, a call for help to the analyst, a communication. Juana, I feel empty. Feel me. Don't leave me alone. Juana is promiscuous. Promiscuity is a defense against abandonment and emptiness. Give me a penis or a child that will fill me and assuage my emptiness and abandonment. 8, to postulate that emptiness pathology is the clinical expression of a painful and failed attempt to work through the schizoid position in Ferber's model. We defined that a schizoid position as a conflict, the schizoid conflict, universal, foundational, and extracting of the human psyche, nodular at the core of the entire pathology, always resignified in the phallic Oedipus conflict. We advance the schizoid conflict to explain pre-Oedipal pathology. The same goes for emptiness pathology. 9, to propose the schizoid conflict as a metapsychological basis for emptiness pathology, and therefore endows this theory with psychoanalytical status. The same happened with Malus and Kuhut's model. Criticized as non-psychoanalytical at the time for lacking a conflict model. 10, to postulate, extrapolating from Ferber, that the quality of emptiness would originally be determined by intrinsic quality of the lost object. Afterwards, however, it would be an attribute given by the ego to certain objects related to the lost object through the primary process, such as the wife or the analyst. Therefore, in good Fervenian language, we say the object would be first reject and then be rejected. The lost object's emptiness quality, ever present in restitution, we determine the clinical form of emptiness and the specificity of the intervening splitting units. 11, emptiness is a poorly pronounced symptom because in borderline pathology it is frequently associated with the schizoid series, while in psychotic pathology it is usually associated with decathesis, a negative symptom. 12, from the age of myth and according to Campbell, emptiness could be a universal element present in all cosmogonies. 13, to discuss the role of the pre-Oedipal father. This is something that is on the fashion now, of the pre-Oedipal father in emptiness pathology. 14, to discuss the psychopathogenesis and clinical importance of a specific fantasy in the emptiness pathology. That's all.
Well, thank you, Dr. Basilia. I'm sure there's a lot to think about and talk about in this presentation. In this segment, we actually have an hour and a half, which is a little bit longer. So we're going to have about 10 minutes of discussion. Anyone have something to say to begin?
Matt Rosa from the Masterson Institute. Dr. Basile, I just wanted to thank you for talking about abandonment. It's in our approach, in the Masterson approach, we see the experience of the patients abandoning the lost object as essentially the curative work. And I just appreciate how you have highlighted the fact that the defenses are that the defenses are actually employed to keep experiences of abandonment out of consciousness. Not only in our view that the object abandons, but ultimately that the patient abandons, which in my experience anyway can be even more difficult for the patient to actually experience the guilt of having to abandon their lost object. So anyway, I just wanted to thank you for that and make that comment.
Do you want to comment on that?
Las defensas se utilizan para mantener este espacio vacío, que es más o menos lo que usted dice.
Las defensas. The pathology as a defense.
Sí. Quería que las defensas se usan.
¿Cómo?
Las defensas se usan para mantener el vacío.
Yes, the emptiness is a defense, like the, as that's what our hypothesis is the same that Rubens says about depression, is a defense to keep unconscious the abandonment anxieties, and the then the possibility of being psychotic.
Ivan Ward, Freud Museum. Could you say just a little bit about there was a hint in the paper, but the relationship between emptiness and the idea of being, the fantasy of being filled with something rotten or rotting. I mean, is there a connection? I mean, there was one of your examples where there seemed to be a connection, but I wondered if you felt that they were between emptiness and the idea of being filled with something rotting or rotten.
La asociación entre el vacío y estar lleno.
¿Entre quién?
Entre el vacío y el estar lleno de algo dañado.
Emptiness comes from two identifications. One identification is primary identification with the empty breast. The baby sucks from an empty breast, which is empty, which is fat, but which protects him from abandonment anxieties and identifies with it, with the breast. First with the breast and then with the mother. With the breast, Fervent says, through a primary identification. and with the mother through a secondary identification, which for me is something very important, because secondary identification means high Oedipal level without Oedipus complex. It's impossible to have, to my opinion, emptiness pathology. To my opinion, any pathology, but especially any emptiness pathology. The specificity of emptiness comes from a primary identification, primary in the sense of for a primary narcissism in the sense of Erwin, which the baby identifies and acquires the quality of empty, and then with the mother, because he continues sucking, and he sucks, he empties the mother. So in secondary, in the deepest complex, the baby becomes identified with an empty mother, a whole object with a part relationship object.
Okay.
I don't know. It is what he asked, no?
Other comments? I noticed, Dr. Vasili, that in your case examples, there also was a link between fusion and emptiness. In a couple of your case examples, the patients talked about feeling fused with the object and then feeling empty. Do you have thoughts about that?
Emptiness is a universal feeling. But one thing is, I'm going to say in Spanish, vivencia de vacío, which is, all of us have vivencia de vacío, is universal, and the other is emptiness feeling, which is pathological, is pathology.
Vivencia del vacío, meaning experiencing the emptiness. It's something that we all feel at the moment in life. But the emptiness, complete emptiness, it's pathological.
Pero all cosmogonies start, according to Campbell, and I think he's right, start explain the world, the origin of the world, universal myths, and they start off with trying to explain the vivencia del vacío, which all human being has. It's like vivencia oceanica that Frost says. Mm-hmm. Like one thing is vivencia de vacío, and the other thing is emptiness field.
Le preguntaba el doctor Polton de que le explicara también un poco más sobre la parte esta que usted marca de fusión.
¿De?
De fusión. De fusión y después vacío en las relaciones sexuales de los pacientes.
There is he died, a very intelligent analyst in Buenos Aires who was for many years a training analyst called Mauricio Valli. He classified anxieties, birth anxieties in closeness, encierro, then transito, and then empty. That's another. Then when the baby goes, is born and goes to the external world, feels a universal feeling of emptiness. That's another good example of at the beginning, he feels engulfed. Mm-hmm. Closed, then separated from the mother, and then vacío. They are universal vivencias. And I want to say feelings on purpose.
experiences.
Okay. I think let's all thank Dr. Basile for
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. I'm going to take this.
Oh.
Watch that coming down.
Okay. The next segment of this session, we're going to watch a video, Reflections on Fairbairn by Kernberg and Sutherland.
So there are two 9-minute segments. The first is with Otto Kernberg, whom I interviewed 20 years ago before the first Fairbairn conference that we did in New York, on which occasion also he couldn't be there, and he sends his greetings. He does have a chapter in the book. He knows more about Fairbairn than anybody I've ever met. And he does it with no preparation, so he really knows it. And I think you'll be able to hear him clearly. The second one is with Jock Sutherland, it was about 1992 maybe, some early 90s. I'm not sure if you'll be able to decipher the language, but I think you'll get the feel of the warmth of his feeling about Fairbairn and the warmth of his personality. This is an interview that Jill conducted also. Kernberg couldn't be here, although he would have liked to be, and he's still absolutely alive and kicking. Jock is, of course, no longer with us, but his inspiration is. Okay.
This brings me to... If you want to talk a little further about Fairbairn, to go back a little more,
brings me
back to what has been most argued about his drive for instinct theory.
Sure.
And I think that here I'm partly in disagreement, but also partly in agreement with Fairbairn, because he postulates that libido is really object seeking, mm-hmm. rather than pleasure seeking, and considers aggression as secondary to the frustration of this need. I would modify this slightly, thinking that libido is object seeking, which is pleasurable. Object seeking, but mm-hmm. object seeking, and pleasure, and the reality principle are originally really one.
All the same thing.
Yeah, all the same. At the same time, I believe that aggression has an equally important role as psychic motivator. Insofar as there are inborn dispositions to aggressive affects in the same way as there are inborn dispositions to libidinal affect.
Right.
And therefore, the inborn disposition is there to both.
To both, right from the beginning.
So to say that aggression is secondary to frustration of libidinal needs... kind of downplays the fact that we're also constitutionally already wired to the two types of responses.
I thought that
the concept of the moral defense was very important contribution to masochism.
Right, and I was looking at your writing about that. Yeah. Do you want to say something about that?
Well, provided an object relation perspective to masochism, in the sense that it didn't derive simply from a very early tendency to turn aggression against the self. But for Fairbairn, and I think rightly so, was much more determined by the need to maintain the internal relationship with a punishing, frustrating object. And in order to make that object acceptable to the self and maintain the relationship, the need to rationalize the object's aggression and integrate the bad superego precursor, one might say, with the idealized one by idealizing the reasons for the aggression. And this then would create a powerful internalized sadistic morality with which the person would agree. And this is the part of the self or the self-representation that is in alliance with the internal saboteur.
Mm-hmm.
And this position, that the self is in alliance with the aggressor, is of course clinically very important, because masochistic patients don't only attack themselves, but there is both a sense of superiority, of moral superiority, and the collusion, the agreement with that which is damaging them. And that deep sense of collusion is very often the most important resistance that one finds. Fairbairn used his model of the central ego and the central and the ideal object, and it's a central self and ideal object, rejecting object, rejecting ego or self, and exciting object, exciting self, is to reformulate, or was a beginning of a reformulation of the tripartite structure. Mm-hmm. He related, of course, to Freud's definition of ego, superego, and it. And independently, Edith Jacobson was doing something similar. Both Fairbairn and Jacobson were struggling with a systematic development of the concept that the unit of internalized dyadic object relation, where the substructures of ego, superego, and it is suprastructures, and in turn those three being the substructures of the personality is superstructure. In other words, an open systems theory of psychic structure, to which they both contributed and really gave an impetus, which I think I have been trying to develop, and is still an important task, because it really links the internalization of early interpersonal experiences of human relations,
right,
to the development of psychic structure. Mm-hmm. Fairbairn had a clarity of thinking and of writing. You read Fairbairn, I mean, I must come, English is my third language, so I'm not an expert to talk about English, but I've been told by people who have an appreciation for the English language that they have the same experience that I have, that there is a clarity about Fairbairn's thinking and writing, which is not that frequent in psychoanalytic writing.
Right.
It was like an early outline when he tried to differentiate the obsessive, the hysteric, the phobic, and the paranoid.
Yes.
Because he hinted there at different organizations of internalized object relations. Mm-hmm. I think it's a very important point, except that there was a certain simplicity of the way in which he put the good object inside or outside. The structures are more complex than that.
Mm-hmm.
But the idea that there are different kind of different molecular arrangements,
right,
of internalized object relation determining the dominant types of pathological character structure, that is very important. Mm-hmm. The influence of trauma that we now know is quite prevalent in certain severe personality disorders,
right,
also can be conceptualized in terms of the internalization of traumatic object relations. Fairbairn's outline lends itself to a conceptualization of the internalization of a relationship with the persecutor, so that victimized persons internalize both victim and victimizer. One aspect of his work that I found also very stimulating, his analysis of dreams.
Mm-hmm.
Like all classical analysts, he used dream analysis quite centrally in his clinical papers. But the way in which he would look for different aspects of the patient's personality to be impersonated by different figures, different individuals in the content of the dream, I thought was very interesting and made a lot of sense clinically. Particularly this dyadic unit of self-representation and object representation as inseparable building blocks.
I'm very thrilled and honored to be able to do this, to be the one to chair this morning's session, and to funnel through myself questions that have been raised in the small groups about the theory that Jacques has been presenting based on his understanding and his relationship with Fairbairn. Fairbairn's idea that introjection was the first defense and that the only motivation for introjection was bad experience, so that what is taken in is a bad object. Many people have been puzzled by this emphasis on the bad. There are questions concerning if so much is focused on the introjection of the bad, where then is the good? Is the unconscious entirely peopled with bad objects? And if so, is this not a very frightening prospect for the person?
When we talked about internalizing the bad objects, a deliberate act of incorporation. Now, I think the difference there is he's talking about an object, that is, a separate kind of person. He's assuming that the original self structure has incorporated the good experience from mother, not by internalizing an image of the person as well, but just taking in all the things that have happened, the way she's been held, has been fed, all these qualities of goodness or non-goodness, as it were, have come into the structure of the central ego there already. So he doesn't separate that as requiring the internalization of a separate object, although that develops later with the growth of perceptual capacity and all that kind of thing. So that Benjamin made clear, I think he does, there is an identification with the mother, so there is an internalization of the mother's goodness has become dissolved inside, permeating the whole of the structure there with the qualities she has imbued. So that is there, if she has been good enough, that, as I tried to say last night, gives herself a feeling of great security and that the outer world is a good place to relate to. That's Winnicott's whole point, see, if you get that good feeling coming into you, then you're not afraid of the outer world, you enjoy exploring it. It's the necessary basis for all the exploratory activity that the child then needs, because you have no hostile or frightened feeling of the outer world. So that's where the good mother internalization mm-hmm. is around, and it's built in.
Yeah. So your point is it's taken in, but not as a defense.
Not
it's
as
taken
a
in as a healthy, normal mechanism.
And metabolized.
Mm-hmm.
I think that was the only word. I think I saw somebody else. I found myself using that word many years ago, that it was kind of metabolized and became, just as food becomes part of the body structure, the good mother's, the emotional experiences permeated the growing content of the structure we're calling the self. Yes,
mm-hmm.
That became the ego. But when the frustration experiences render the child, they make prominent the helpless feeling, because the child can't control the powerful adult, and so you then get the notion of the internalization of that situation of the outer adult being taken inside, and as Winnicott would point out later, is then the capacity to play is what forms the foundation of learning to manage the bad object. You can think, you can feel, you can invent ways of dealing with the bad object, hopefully, you see. So that the internalization of spirit is to try to control the bad object, to manage it. So, but you can see it's a separate kind, a different, a qualitatively a different kind of relationship and operation. That's the frustrating object. Even the bad object, if that's the wrong word, because as we have said, it is both good and bad at that time. It has the exciting qualities of the other. But it's the frustrating object, as the desired disaster. A living, feeling organism has this quality. And of course the beauty, if you think of from the evolutionary point of view, it's a masterly creation. Because how can an organism deal with a multiplicity of experiences and stimuli coming in, and how can it be prepared for what's painful and deal with each one? So you have a mechanism whereby anything that's disturbing the well-being is felt in the general headquarters as pain. In the central quality, the affect. So the affect is always struck me as an ingenious way of creating a monitoring system which could deal with all kinds of stimuli and yet could set in motion internally anything painful or unpleasant, can set in motion the reactive mechanism, you see, a cry of protest or a yell or what cry of what have you, or go away or all that kind of thing can be set in motion from this general message of unpleasant affect. And I have felt from early on, I'm not sure that the word, you see, repression is necessary for the early thing, because an innate property of affect would have to be splitting. The system is a whole, it's a gestalt. If there's a painful sort of thing inside, the spontaneous tendency of such a system is to extrude the painful bit. So then it gets split off. Mm-hmm. But I'm using pain in this general sense of I don't like that, and the splitting is a process that could occur. I feel as a property of the innate affect system, the tone, the affect tone. This bit here's something horrible. You know, just get away. So it gets split off, all the unpleasant bit, and naturally, what is split off is the bit of self that's feeling the affect and the relationship there. So the whole bit of the self system gets split off, not just the object. The affect that comes into any experience is governed by the content of what's going on inside the organism and the nature of what's coming at it. You know, it's a combination. This is a thing of getting used. See, we've been so brought up with 19th century science and Freud. The whole model for conceiving personality development was a mechanical engineering. You're talking about solid structures all the time with cybernetic control, you know, of negative feedback. Anything gets out of place, you get it back to its same state as it was in. Whereas we're dealing with open, growing, developing systems where positive feedback, that is something that is happening and you create a new bit, as it were, you go for that, you see, sort of expansion, growth and development, and permanent dynamics are the whole model. This sort of equilibrium, solid structure, the 19th century stuff, that's only one area of science. It has no relevance in living organisms. The second law of thermodynamics, where everything is working towards a steady state around the entropy maximizing, that's not on in living organisms. Living organisms are negentropic. They are incorporating food stuff all the time to keep up their energy system. They're not dependent on us. You see, something that was born in the system to start with. They're creating it all the time. So it's a permanent dynamic process. And we've got to think of, we've got to think of the self and the personality as a constant developing system, just exactly like the body, taking in all the time, keeping its structuring going, adding new structures, and splitting off unwanted bits. you have to remember the position, the social position Fairbairn was in. He had become a devoted student of psychoanalysis. Mm-hmm. He was 400 miles away from where they are, the nearest analyst at that time. And then war broke out as he was getting his ideas formulated, the schizoid, the first paper. Travel stopped, you couldn't travel very readily. And he was very friendly with Glover and with Ernest Jones, he had met them, and he was very eager to be in on the analytic movement, but he didn't know how, because they were very snooty about outsiders, and they were quite right, because they didn't want wild behaviour. They wanted to safeguard the professional standards. And after Fairbairn read that paper on the gender identity, the woman with the ambiguous sex,
yes.
That was a very impressive paper, because, and then he was made an associate member of shortly after a membership on that paper, because they could see.
Well, there's an hour more of him and an hour more of Otto, but that'll have to do for today.
Do you want to comment on
that? Well, I don't know if there are comments about what you've seen and heard. I gather you could hear it. Good, 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 good. Yeah, I think
it's worth having a bit of discussion about it.
All right, so we can do that. Yeah, Jim, why don't you open the curtain a little?
Well, I want to comment something about the Campbell communication. Well, he said the relation is the seeking object is the pleasure seeking object. Well, not always, because Fairbairn abandoned the pleasure principle because he worked with children who were abused, and these children maintained their adherence to their parents. These parents were maltreatment parents. And this is not a pleasure.
Yeah. It's a place I don't really agree with Otto. He really is working to keep a fairly classical framework intact while being blended with Fairbairn's system. And Fairbairn's point was it really isn't the pleasure, it's the tie to the object. So it's a place of disagreement, but it's a respectful disagreement at the same time. Yeah. Yeah, yeah.
I think he, in terms of Otto Kernberg, I think he, maintains aggression, I think at his peril, because, that's why the libido has to find a pleasurable object, because of the innate aggression that he holds to. There's a paper that I'm actually working on about thinking about Thanatos as an experience of reality. Because Freud never, at least as I read Freud, he unlike with libido and Eros, Eros is the sort of love reality. Libido is it in us. I don't see in Freud a similar, we talk about aggression and death instinct, but Thanatos doesn't have a direct correlate in Freud's theory, in human beings. So how we get rid of the frustrating object, how we abandon the frustrating, the lost object. We do, I think, galvanize aggression, but not in the way that Kernberg sees aggression as the basis for the split. Anyway.
If Otto were here, his aggression would, I'm sure, put everything to rest. Absolutely. I think the death instinct's not a good idea as a theoretical origin of motivation. I think Fairbairn was wrong about if something happens in everybody all the time, why would you say it's secondary? Everybody has aggression. I think the explanation for its biological function is one thing, but we all have it. And it certainly has been a ubiquitous tendency in human affairs. And I think it's very different to say, to try to understand something teleologically and to say it's only secondary, we wouldn't need it otherwise. But I think that's a very complicated point that is going to go beyond what we'll settle today. Anyway, yeah, maybe one more.
On the other end of the scale are murderers and repeated rapists, which I used to work with in prison. I mean, one guy, I said, do you have any regrets of murdering your wife? And he said, yes, if I knew I was going to get life, I would have got my mother-in-law too. but it's kind of like the attempt to murder off or to kill off the bad object of which you cannot gain power. And what I'm thinking now is that perhaps that's about the stalker, the obsessiveness of the stalker.
Okay, I do want to say that an aggressive tie to an object is a tie to the object. That's really what Fairbairn helped us see. This is a tie to the object. It's not a giving up. And in many of our patients, that aggression that ties them to the object and ties the internal saboteur to the rejecting or persecuting object is very, very sturdy. Yeah, Jill.
Yeah. Whether you agree with Fairbairn's model or not, whether he got all the details right or not, to me is not so much the point as that he developed a cybernetic system, a way of looking at parts of the self in interaction and in communication with the world and growing and evolving over time. That's what means so much to me. And I think that what you heard Jacques talking about was bringing it up to date with modern evolutionary theory and systems theory. The whole idea of complex interacting systems operating according to feedback loops. It just says Fairbairn was operating at a time when science was changing and moving and developing, and he was part of that culture and he took it into the realm of personal development. And Jacques' point is, you know, there it is. Admire it for what it is, and we'll see how it moves forward to help us understand the self in the social system.
Mm. Well, we've heard that he knew that energy and matter couldn't be divorced. It changes the system. Freud was limited by the 19th century conception of physics and thought things tended to run down because that's what physical systems do with that have to generate their own energy. But people are always generating towards higher levels of complexity and, as he said, autonomy, which is where his work took him, as you can see in Jill's collections of Jacques' writings. But Fairbairn and even Jacques didn't have the advantage of chaos theory, which really says something else about the complexity of these cybernetic systems and the ways of organization that give us a whole nother level of seeing them, and there will be something else that will help us see more. I feel impressed, and the reason I started in editing a much longer, lovely interview that Jill did, is I think he really gives us a way of understanding this idea of incorporating only the bad with the idea that what's taken for granted and is the whole context of development and growth is a good, nurturing parent, mothers, fathers. So it isn't incorporated in the same discrete way to be struggled with inside. And I find that just very, very helpful to kind of get to this idea of the motive for incorporation. It's different. The motive for incorporation of a discrete object is different from what sustains the individual from the beginning and the need for that.
Okay, great. We need to move on. I would like now to introduce Dr. Hilary Beattie. She is a psychologist and psychoanalyst in private practice in New York City. She's a faculty member of Columbia University Department of Psychiatry and the Columbia Psychoanalytic Center. Her research interests are in psychoanalytic approaches to literature and the Scottish contribution to psychoanalysis. She stems from Edinburgh on her father's side, and in a previous life she taught history at Yale University. Her title has changed a bit from what's printed in the program. It is now Fairbairn and Homosexuality, Revisions to a Biography. And I'll just turn it over to you.
Thank you. No. Yes, light. Okay, thank you. Today I'm going to talk about Fairbairn the man, the human being, rather than the theorist about whom you've heard a great deal already. I have to say I greatly admire John Sutherland's 1989 biography of him. Can you hear me actually? Yeah, good. But I've always... No. Oh. I admire John Sutherland's biography of Fairbairn. Can you hear that? Yes, okay. But I've always been skeptical of his analysis of Fairbairn's intimate and sexually revealing self-analytic notes. Reading clinically between the lines, I sensed evasions and obfuscations, an impression that was strengthened when I realized that Sutherland had suppressed any mention of Fairbairn's final publication, A Note on the Origin of Male Homosexuality, which came out in 1964, the last year of his life. Luckily, as you've heard, the complete self-analytic notes, along with other personal material like diaries, appointment books, medical records, and so on, were recently made available to the public after Fairbairn's family generously donated them to the National Library of Scotland. These sources are supplemented by a 1987 memoir, A Life is Too Short, by Fairbairn's younger son, Nicholas, a flamboyant character who made a career as a lawyer and conservative politician. Like all memoirs, it's self-serving and has to be used with caution. But Nicholas grew up close to his father and offers, among other things, interesting sidelights on his parents' troubled marriage. There are also the sometimes informative annotations in Fairbairn's book collection, now in Edinburgh University Library. All this was available to Sutherland, but he was writing in a very different era. From the perspective of the 21st century, it's easy to forget how pervasively homophobic British society was for much of the 20th, all of the 20th. It's easy, male homosexuality had actually been illegal in Britain since 1861, and while there was always a homosexual subculture, especially in elite and literary circles, this had to be discreet, particularly after the moral panic caused by the Oscar Wilde trial in 1895. Even after World War II, when the movement for homosexual law reform gathered force, it met with considerable resistance from the judiciary, the press, and the medical establishment. The Wolfenden Committee issued its report recommending decriminalization of homosexuality between consenting adults in 1957, but this took a decade to become law in 1967, and then it applied only to England and Wales. In Scotland, owing to opposition from conservative elements in the Presbyterian Church, the press, politicians, and public opinion, this step was delayed until 1980, only 9 years before the Sutherland biography, marking the centennial of Fairbairn's birth. And of course, Calvinist bourgeois Scotland of the late Victorian and Edwardian eras, in which all sexual matters were shrouded in secrecy, was the milieu in which Fairbairn grew up. Now, psychoanalysts have been no more immune to entrenched social homophobia than anyone else. Resisting Freud's more tolerant view of male homosexuality as an irreversible but not pathological developmental variation. The history of their determined but intellectually incoherent efforts to stigmatize it as a harmful perversion rooted in early psychodynamics is a sorry story, ably chronicled by scholars like Kenneth Lewis. Indeed, as Lewis suggests, analytic attitudes to homosexuality may have amounted to a collective intellectual rationalization that defied any critical examination.
Only in 1991 did the American Psychoanalytic Association change its party line and end its discrimination against homosexuals as candidates and as training analysts. Now, Ronald Fairbairn was a psychoanalyst who not only came to hold quite explicit views on male homosexuality, but documented his own psychosexual history with remarkable candor in his self-analytic notes, partly in an effort to understand his intractable urinary inhibition. My intuition from reading Sutherland that some of this might have had to do with deeply buried conflicts over his own sexual orientation, and that examination of the complete notes might offer an unparalleled opportunity to see the effects of entrenched homophobia on a brilliant analyst of the earlier generation. Of course, I too worried about the ethics of exposing Fairbairn to this kind of posthumous scrutiny, but like Sutherland, I concluded that its relevance to the development of Fairbairn's theories made it important, especially since parts of the material had already been published in the biography and analyzed in somewhat misleading ways. Sutherland, besides, I would assume, having his own prejudices and blind spots to contend with, was surely concerned for the feelings of Fairbairn's family, whom he knew well, clearly, and I have to say that I deeply regret if any of my own findings should cause pain to any of his descendants. Now, just to preface this, I should say that, as I explain in my chapter in the volume, Fairbairn, as a theorist, does see male egocentric male homosexuality as a perversion rooted in defective early object relations, above all with the mother, although his theories about the exact mechanism whereby it happened went back and forth over 30 years. He considers it both biologically and socially abnormal, even if he never advocates legal sanctions, but rather treatment, though he's not very optimistic about that. But men who struggle against their homosexual leanings, who reject them, he terms psychoneurotics, who may learn to sublimate their desires in socially acceptable ways. And as we've heard, for Fairbairn, I think sexual desire in itself becomes problematic, since if the fundamental aim of libido, in his view, is to achieve a good relationship with the object, then the pleasure principle is itself inherently psychopathological, and any seeking of sexual pleasure merely for its own sake represents a deterioration of behavior. Fairbairn's earlier self-analytic notes from 1939 to 40 show that his sexually puritanical mother made ferocious war on his masculine self and on any attempt to derive pleasure for its own sake, from his own penis. And I think this "for its own sake" is important because he reiterates it very poignantly from time to time, that having pleasure for its own sake in your own physical being is wrong, which I think underlies some of his theorizing about libido. In adolescence, this led to agonizing conflicts over masturbation, which the boy attempted to relieve by urination, which in turn made going to the bathroom sexually exciting, and surely played a role in his later fears of urinating in front of other men. His father, who suffered from the same inhibition, was of no help as a role model. Sutherland discusses all this in terms of Fairbairn's inadequate sense of masculinity and somewhat feminine identifications, but he resolutely avoids any homosexual implications, even when it comes to things like Fairbairn's early enjoyment of anal penetration and his excited fantasies of tearing off his penis and having sex in the female position while being penetrated by something, presumably a penis, but not formulated as such. He ignores the fact that a penis is usually attached to another man, but Sutherland omits the more graphic parts of this fantasy while also rearranging the material so as to obscure some of the erotic associations, notably to the episode when young Fairbairn was attacked by his mother for denying the sexual nature of his chance encounter with a man in a park. All this is in my chapter. You can find more detail there. Here, as an example of what's in the later material, I'd like to focus on this. It's mostly from the 1950s. It comprises data drawings of dreams and more written notes, which aren't, for the most part, aren't dated, but you can sort of establish a sequence. Sutherland says little about these drawings, other than that they demonstrate the frightening quality of the little boy's inner world, and he dismisses the notes as repetitive and not illuminating. And there I say I really don't agree with him, especially since these later notes include three complicated dreams, some with associations. One of those dreams I discuss briefly at the end of my chapter, preceded by a summary of what the later notes indicate about Fairbairn's slowly dawning awareness that homosexual fears and perhaps even desires were connected with his phobia of urinating in public lavatories. And I have to remind you that in those days, men's lavatories were the main locus for brief homosexual encounters, a pastime which was known as cottaging, because of the little cottage-like structures in which many public lavatories were housed. Now, right now, I want to give you a sample of my current research, taking a more historical, contextual approach to try to understand why Fairbairn might have resumed his self-analysis when he did. It starts with the dream drawings, mostly from late 1950 and lacking in commentary. But these drawings allude clearly to childhood sexual traumas and fantasies, including the drawing I reproduce in my chapter of the boy with the homosexual man together facing the huge mother with her menacing sword while the clock on the wall signals the irreversible passage of maturational time, I think. Other monstrous or grotesquely distorted female figures abound, sometimes armed or attacking with sticks, swords, or axes, sometimes leading the kilted boy by a leash or chain, while father, identifiable by bald head and facial hair, sits off to one side or turns his back on the action. The women seem mostly to represent mother with a capital M, but there's one depicted full face and wearing glasses, who I think can only be Fairbairn's wife, for on either side of her is a bottle, one seemingly of wine, one of spirits, while on her head and shoulders perch a bird, a rat, and a monkey. Arguably, then, what set off this lurid dreaming had to do with Fairbairn's marriage to his deteriorating marriage to his troubled alcoholic wife. Sutherland presents Fairbairn always as the long-suffering victim of his wife's attacks, motivated by her hostility to his works, but he never wonders whether sexual neglect of her may have played a role. Their son Nicholas, who claims that he was brought up to worship his father and despise his mother, hints repeatedly that this was a sexless marriage in which Fairbairn was rigidly insensitive to Mary's emotional suffering, a kind of passive aggression which actually accords well with Fairbairn's ruminations about his own character structure. The rest of the dream drawings are from September 13, 1952, which, according to Fairbairn's appointment book, was the day following a visit from their daughter with the man she was to marry the following April. These two feature fearsome women, one with short hair and skirt, beaky nose, and a phallic knife, who could also allude to Mary, perhaps condensed with mother, as the source of all Fairbairn's sexual troubles. Maybe the daughter's future marriage aroused emotional turmoil in both spouses, I'm just guessing, but only a fortnight later, Mary Fairbairn made a suicidal gesture, after which she sought medical help, but ended up dying of multiple organ failure, and I'm indebted for these details to Cosmo Fairbairn. Fairbairn was deeply shocked by this tragedy, but things in later years gradually seemed to improve, and according to Sutherland, he enjoyed much more social life in the rest of this decade, as well as a more congenial professional atmosphere. The written notes, probably from 1955, are preceded by a pair of index cards from June 1954, where Fairbairn lists the dynamic factors relevant to his own urinary phobia alongside the closely parallel factors in the case of X. and he also includes the statement, male homosexuality as an attempt to escape from incestuous situation of mother into a community of men who are also escaping from that situation. Now, X, with whom he compares himself, is identified with his real name on the other card, and in fact is the patient he calls Morris in his publications. Morris first appeared in 1954 in On the Nature of Hysterical States, and for the next 10 years, including that final paper, was to be the single case on which Fairbairn based his efforts to clarify the etiology of homosexuality. Morris's history had uncanny similarities with Fairbairn's own, especially the castrating mother who attacked his penis, and I suspect that it was some growing identification with him that could have contributed to Fairbairn's starting his second self-analysis. Another factor was certainly the 1955 translation of Schreber's memoirs, which stimulated Fairbairn's primal scene theory of homosexuality, which he also illustrated with Morris. Now, more evidence suggesting something new in Fairbairn's life at this time comes from his appointment books, which between November 1954 and July 1955 record massage from Willie Kerr, 58 times in all. This occurred typically at the end of the workday, often right before or after sessions with Morris. Now, Willie Kerr, as I now know thanks to Cosmo Fairbairn, was a masseur, possibly blinded in World War I, who lived across the way, next door to the Fairbairn's old home at 18 Lansdowne Crescent. I don't know any more than that, but the massage sessions do seem to hint at some relaxation of Fairbairn's strict self-control in enjoyment of physical contact with another man, even if it might have had to be rationalized in some way. Another hint of some breakthrough in awareness in this period comes from Fairbairn's copy of Harry Stack Sullivan's The Psychiatric Interview, published in 1954. At the end of the chapter on problems of communication, Fairbairn notes that he found it pleasant to read, but difficult to follow, grasp, as well as confusing. But at one point in the chapter, Sullivan describes his technique for assessing the patient's handicaps to using, I quote, the totality of his abilities, otherwise known as the great problem. If the patient hesitantly admits to a sexual problem, Sullivan immediately replies, and doubtless a homosexual problem. After which, he says, the patient confesses to frequent sexual relations with a member of his own sex or lack of interest in such relations with the opposite sex. Now, Fairbairn, who usually, in all the books of his I looked at, he drew one light, very careful line beside paragraphs he wanted to emphasize. But in this section, he sidelined it with five long, heavy, slashing black lines, something he did nowhere else. That's the only instance I gasped when I came across this. Now, Fairbairn probably had no idea that Sullivan was himself homosexual, but Sullivan here does refuse to pathologize homosexuality, saying that he doesn't treat such, I quote, alleged entities, but simply tries to find out what stands in the way of the patient's making the conventional adjustment, which is regarded as normal. My impression here was that the startled Fairbairn suddenly lost distance, almost as if he himself were being interviewed by Sullivan, who had suddenly broken through his defenses. Now, there's much more I could say about the later notes, and there isn't time for here, obviously, but that will have to be the subject of another article. But I have to stress again, as I did in my chapter, that I'm not interested particularly in where to place Fairbairn himself on the spectrum of sexual orientation. I mean, I think that's a somewhat trivial question. What I'm really interested in is the constraints he faced in his completely solitary efforts to understand his crippling psychosexual symptom amid fears of destructive inner forces that could sometimes lead him to thoughts of suicide. And he has a very poignant little manuscript in the archive, which I read before looking at the notes, which it's called Knowledge and Self-Analysis versus Psychoanalysis. And he says very poignantly that the only factor that overcomes resistance is the transference relationship to another human being, the analyst. And it was so sad that other than a very brief two-year analysis in the 1920s, he had absolutely nobody to whom he could talk about this. Doc Sutherland says in the biography he had no idea about even the urinary symptom until after Fairbairn died. And I also think in conclusion that there's a tragic irony in the fact that psychoanalysis itself, in so many ways a liberating force in the understanding of human sexuality, should have oppressed and deformed the lives of distinguished analysts whose fundamental desires it proscribed as deviant and harmful. Well, thank you. And I apologize for not showing any of the drawings, but I'd have to get complicated permission from the library, so it was just too much to do.
Well, thank you, Dr. Beattie. That fascinating glimpse into Fairbairn's interior life. We have 10 minutes for comments.
Can I just make a statement? I think people love as best they can.
Mm-hmm.
Simply as that. And some people can't because of the wealth of experience. But you know, when I'm listening to you talking about his urinary thing, I was thinking that's identification with his father. I think of Freud, mourning and melancholia. And I remember Worth working with a chronic inpatient at the Maudsley who had taken on board all his father's habits.
Mm-hmm.
Cold wife, cold mother. But he wasn't homosexual. He was stuck with his cold wife.
Mm-hmm.
But I still think, you know, you can do a developmental history.
Mm-hmm.
You can still do a developmental history, but you don't think it's a perversion. It's
No, I'm not saying...
How do we come to love the people we do?
Of course. I'm not calling it a perversion. Not at all. But he had a tormented developmental history. It's very clear. And I should also say that I think there is one drawing, you know, Marie Hoffman talked about the trauma of being stuck in the railway carriage with his father, watching the father urinate while the women were sort of shut off behind screens. There is a drawing of that episode where the father is sitting on one side with an enormous exposed penis and the boy is sitting directly opposite him with his hair standing erect on end. I think there was something incredibly both frightening and seductive about this episode for Fairbairn, and I think it raises some questions about his father that obviously we can't answer, but Fairbairn does say in the essay on child assault in 1935 that men who are caught exposing themselves in public are usually, he says, usually not aiming at women but at boys in the vicinity. And he's very worried about the corrupting effects on boys. So I think, plus his father gave him enemas and suppositories repeatedly. And Fairbairn says elsewhere that this can lead to sexual libido being diverted to the anus. So I think in a way he experienced those enemas and suppositories as a kind of repeated seduction almost. Must have been very frightening as well as arousing.
Other comments?
Well, I've had a brief look at some of these drawings, and I didn't see that one, but the ones of this very large mother and very small little boys or small husbands being led around on a chain. I mean, I'm sure he knew what he was drawing, and it's self-referential. And these were self-referential drawings, and I didn't know that these could correlate with these dreams. But he was really working very hard at it in this period between marriages, after which he married quite happily, as Cosmo was saying last night. so that it wasn't that, that he that then took him away from women, but maybe there was something about being able to do this work that let him into a relationship that felt much better. I certainly agree with what you said, that, that Jacques entirely blamed his wife for all of this. And it's in the same way that when Freud wrote about Dora, she entirely blamed the mother. She just took the father's word for it. He took the father's word for it, even though Freud thought he was a crook and a liar. But he still said, well, this woman obviously was just a housewife, a neurotic housewife. But all right, so these are the limits of understanding, and Jacques was Fairbairn's friend, and analysand, and acolyte. I mean,
And there were things one didn't say in those days, and are not easy to say even in these days, sadly.
I have a comment from here.
I just wanted to thank you for that really all-embracing historical aspect, because I think because analysis gives us the tools to understand things, we can omnipotently want to deny how we are subject to the what is socially around and how we take in the period. And it really matters that we look and see how people have suffered and are suffering in each period. It was really helpful. Thank you.
I'll just make a linking comment, because I think you've tied it so much to the ethos of the day around this particular issue that in the afternoon we're going to have a panel tying it to the social unconscious and to the issues around analysis and the limitations of our thinking that we impose on ourselves when we can't consider the kind of context in which all of us live and work. Mm-hmm.
We have time for another comment or two, if anyone has anything to say.
I hope you're not all too shocked.
Just wonder if you could say a little more about Fairbairn's theory of homosexuality, then.
Well, it's complicated. Basically, it all goes back to the mother. I mean, his theory is that we all start out heterosexual, and that it's neglecting and smothering and ambivalent mothers that cause the problem by turning the boy away from women as sexual objects. Though he also, at certain points, I mean, he's very reluctant to admit attraction to the father, and in the Schreber case discussion, he completely trashes Freud's theory of it as being a sort of negative Oedipal longing for his father. But it's, he goes back and forth. At the very end, in that last publication, he says basically it's a longing for the breast. The penis is the father's breast, which is very sort of reductionistic, and his powers were failing at that time. But it's interesting that in that those declining years, when apparently he was having mini strokes or he wasn't as mentally acute, that his one publication should have been on this topic, and also that Morris was one of the patients, there were only, I think, two, who accompanied him to the very end. It was almost like they had a sort of twinship. And I suspect he learned a great deal about himself from working with Morris. It was a kind of mutual therapy analysis for both.
Yes, we've got one last one.
Hi. I know that we've discussed this, as it were, elsewhere, and also other people have discussed this. The fact is that in the discussion of the Oedipus complex, he says that the child resolves the Oedipus complex for themselves. And I at the time, left this, or imagined that this opened up the way for gender identity to be, as it were, determined in part by the child themselves. In other words, it was a choice that they were able to make on the basis of their experience of their parents. And I know that, that you have put forward arguments against that viewpoint, but it's also a viewpoint that I think is shared by Gomez in her paper.
Right.
And, or in her book, I should say. So I just wondered if you had a few comments about that.
Well, I think actually Gomez is wrong here, at least certainly in the case of homosexuality. And when you say the child chooses his attitude, I mean, I don't think that happens so consciously. I mean, it's a result of all kinds of forces. It's an outcome of all sorts of identifications and so on. But Fairbairn makes it very clear that he thinks homosexuality is a perversion and a pathological choice. And he has a correspondence with an American psychiatrist called John Frank Pave, whose only publication actually is in the Fairbairn Fest Trip in 1963 that I've been able to trace. But anyway, discussing Pave's ideas about a cure for homosexuality, and Fairbairn states quite trenchantly that A, it's incurable, and B, it's not normal, it's a pathology, it's a perversion, it's, you know, he is biologically and socially abnormal. I mean, he leaves no possible doubt, and I don't know just when that was written. There's no date on it, and I haven't been able to track anything from Pave then. So, but I suspect this was part of his own defensiveness. And interestingly, his son Nicholas in the memoir says that he and his father frequently discussed sexual matters, and that Fairbairn, who was anxious to protect Nicholas, I'm about to end. Okay, one sentence or two. That Fairbairn told him repeatedly that homosexuality was caused by mothers, you know, who were neglectful and rejecting and overprotective, and that he didn't want him to suffer from that kind of mother, which is one reason he sort of kept him away from his mother, which is interesting.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Beattie. And also Dr. Basile and the Sharks for bringing the videos. So lunchtime.